This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Ship of Fools, how a selfish ruling class is bringing America to the brink of revolution. By Tucker Carlson. Read by the author.
For Susie. Introduction. Our Ship of Fools. Imagine you're a passenger on a ship. You're in the middle of the ocean, weeks from land. No matter what happens, you can't get off. This doesn't bother you because there are professional sailors in charge. They know what they're doing. The ship is steady and heading in the right direction. You're fine. Then one day you realize that something horrible has happened. Maybe there was a mutiny overnight. Maybe the captain and the first mate fell overboard. You're not sure. But it's clear the crew is in charge now, and they've gone insane. They seem grandiose and aggressive, maybe drunk. They're gorging on the ship's stores with such abandon, it's obvious there won't be enough food left for you. You can't tell them this because they've banned acknowledgement of physical reality. Anyone who points out the consequences of what they're doing gets keel-hauled. Most terrifying of all, the crew has become incompetent. They have no idea how to sail. They're spinning the ship's wheel like they're playing roulette and cackling like mental patients. The boat is listing, taking on water, about to sink. They're totally unaware that any of this is happening. As waves wash over the deck, they're awarding themselves majestic new titles and raising their own salaries. You look on in horror, helpless and desperate. You have nowhere to go. You're trapped on a ship of fools. Plato imagined this scene in the Republic. He never mentioned what happened to the ship. It would be nice to know. What was written as an allegory is starting to feel like a documentary, as generations of misrule threaten to send our country beneath the waves. The people who did it don't seem aware of what they've done. They don't want to know, and they don't want you to tell them. Facts threaten their fantasies. And so they continue as if what they're doing is working, making mistakes and reaping consequences. They were predictable even to Greek philosophers thousands of years before the internet. They're fools. The rest of us are their passengers. Why did America elect Donald Trump? It seems like a question the people in charge might ask. Virtually nobody thought Trump could become president. Trump himself had no idea. For much of the race, his critics dismissed Trump's campaign as a marketing ploy. Initially, it probably was. Yet somehow, Trump won. Why? Donald Trump isn't the sort of candidate you'd vote for lightly. His voters meant it. Were they endorsing Trump as a man? His personal decency? His command of policy? His hairstyle? Did millions of Americans see his Access Hollywood tape and think, finally, a candidate who speaks for me? Probably not. Donald Trump was in many ways an unappealing figure. He never hid that. Voters knew it. They just concluded that the options were worse. And not just Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party, but the Bush family and their donors and the entire Republican leadership, along with the hedge fund managers and media luminaries and corporate executives and Hollywood tastemakers and think tank geniuses and everyone else who created the world as it was in the fall of 2016, the people in charge. Trump might be vulgar and ignorant, but he wasn't responsible for the many disasters America's leaders created. Trump didn't invade Iraq or bail out Wall Street. He didn't lower interest rates to zero or open the borders or sit silently by as the manufacturing sector collapsed and the middle class died. You couldn't really know what Trump might do as president, but he didn't do any of that. There was also the possibility that Trump might listen. At times, he seemed interested in what voters thought. The people in charge demonstrably weren't. Virtually none of their core beliefs had majority support from the population they governed. It was a strange arrangement for a democracy. In the end, it was unsustainable. Trump's election wasn't about Trump. It was a throbbing middle finger in the face of America's ruling class. It was a gesture of contempt, a howl of rage, the end result of decades of selfish and unwise decisions made by selfish and unwise leaders. Happy countries don't elect Donald Trump president. Desperate ones do. In retrospect, the lesson seemed obvious. Ignore voters for long enough, and you get Donald Trump. Yet the people at whom the message was aimed never received it. Instead of pausing, listening, thinking, and changing, America's ruling class withdrew into a defensive crouch. Beginning on election night, they explained away their loss with theories as pat and implausible as a summer action movie. Trump won because fake news tricked simple-minded voters. Trump won because Russian agents hacked the election. Trump won because mouth breathers in the provinces were mesmerized by his gold jet and shiny cufflinks. Trump won because he's a racist, and that's what voters secretly wanted all along. None of these explanations withstand scrutiny. They're fables that reveal more about the people who tell them than about the 2016 election results. Yet they seem strangely familiar to me. I covered Bill Clinton's two elections. I remember telling lies like this to myself. If you were a conservative in 1992, Bill Clinton drove you insane. He was a glib, inexperienced BS artist from nowhere running against an uninspiring but basically honorable incumbent, and for reasons that weren't clear, winning. Clinton was shifty and dishonest. That was obvious to conservatives. Somehow voters couldn't see it. They liked Clinton. Conservatives believed they could win if they warned voters about the real Bill Clinton. They tried everything. Jennifer Flowers, the draft-dodging letters, Whitewater, Hillary's shady investments. All of Bill Clinton's moral failings emerged during that campaign. Clinton turned out to be every bit as sleazy as conservatives claimed. It didn't matter. He won anyway. Conservatives blame the media. 25 years later, it's clear that conservatives were the delusional ones. Voters knew from the beginning exactly who Bill Clinton was. They knew because voters always know. In politics, as in life, nothing is really hidden, only ignored. A candidate's character is transparent. Voters understood Clinton's weaknesses, they just didn't care. The secret to Clinton's resilience was simple. He took positions that voters agreed with on topics they cared about. At a time when many American cities were virtually uninhabitable because of high crime rates, Clinton ran against crime. In a period when a shrinking industrial economy had left millions without work, Clinton ran on jobs. Once he got elected, Clinton seemed to forget how he'd won. He spent the first 6 months in office responding to the demands of his donors, a group far more affluent and ideological than his voters. Clinton's new priorities seemed to mirror those of the New York Times editorial page. Gun control, global warming, gays in the military. His approval rating tanked. Newt Gingrich and the Republicans took over Congress in the first midterm election. Clinton quickly learned his lesson. He scurried back to the middle and stayed there for the next 6 years, through scandal and impeachment. Clinton understood that as long as he stayed connected to the broad center of American public opinion, voters would overlook his personal shortcomings. It's the oldest truth of electoral politics. Give people what they want and you win. That's how democracy works. Somehow, Bill Clinton's heirs learned nothing from the experience. They mimicked his speaking style and his slickness. Some had similar personal lives. They forgot about paying attention to the public's opinion about issues. Meanwhile, America changed. The country went through several momentous but little publicized transformations that made it much harder to govern. Our leaders didn't seem to notice. At exactly the moment when America needed prudent, responsive leadership, the ruling class got dumber and more insular. The first and most profound of these changes was the decline of the middle class. A vibrant, self-sustaining bourgeoisie is the backbone of most successful nations, but it's essential to a democracy. Democracies don't work except in middle-class countries. In 2015, for the first time in its history, the United States stopped being a predominantly middle-class country. In 1970, the year after I was born, well over 60% of American adults ranked as middle class. That year, middle class wage earners took home 62% of all income paid nationally. By 2015, America's wealth distribution looked very different, a lot more Latin American. Middle class households collected only 43% of the national income, while the share for the rich had surged from 29% to almost 50%. Fewer than half of adults lived in middle-income households. A majority of households qualified as either low-income or high-income. America was becoming a country of rich and poor, and the rich were richer than ever. People who once flew first class now took net jets. Over the same period in which manufacturing declined, making the middle class poorer, the finance economy boomed, making the rich wealthier than ever before. This happened over decades, but the recession of 2008 accelerated the disparities. During the crash of the housing market, more than a quarter of all household wealth in America evaporated. When the smoke cleared and the recovery began, the richest American families controlled a larger share of the economy than they did before the recession. Over time, this trend reshaped America. What had been essentially an egalitarian country, where people from every income group save the very top and the very bottom mixed regularly, has become increasingly stratified. In 1980, it would have been unremarkable for a family in the highest tax bracket to eat regularly at McDonald's, stay in motels, and take vacations by car. A few decades later, that is nearly impossible to imagine. There aren't many successful executives eating Big Macs at rest stops on the New Jersey Turnpike, or even many college graduates. Only hookers and truck drivers stay in motels. Most affluent people under 40 have never been inside one. The rich now reside on the other side of a rope line from everyone else. They stand in their own queues at the airport, sleep on their own restricted floors in hotels. They watch sporting events from skyboxes while everyone else sits in the stands. They go to different schools. They eat different food. They ski on private mountains with people very much like themselves. Suddenly, America has a new class system. Neither party is comfortable talking about this. Traditionally, income inequality was a core Democratic concern. But the party, long the standard bearer for the working class, has reoriented completely. The party's base has shifted to the affluent, and its priorities now mirror those of progressive professionals in Washington, New York, and Silicon Valley. 40 years ago, Democrats would be running elections on the decline of the middle class and winning. Now the party speaks almost exclusively about identity politics, abortion, and abstract environmental concerns like climate change. Republicans, meanwhile, have never wanted to talk about the gap between rich and poor. The party of business rejected the very idea of income inequality, in part because it sounded like a theory concocted by French intellectuals to discredit capitalism. When pressured, Republicans tended to dismiss reports of inequality with a shrug. They assume the American economy is basically just. Rich people have earned their wealth, the poor have earned their poverty. If anything, conservatives pointed out, the poor in America are rich by international standards. They have iPhones and cable TV. How poor can they really be? This misses the point. Prosperity is a relative measure. It doesn't matter how much brightly colored plastic crap I can buy from China. If you can buy more, you're the rich one. I'm poor by comparison. Poverty doesn't cause instability. Envy does. This is why grossly unequal societies tend to collapse, while egalitarian ones endure. America thrived for 250 years mostly because of its political stability. The country had no immense underclass plotting to smash the system. There was not a dominant cabal of the ultra-wealthy capable of overpowering the majority. The country was fundamentally stable. On the strata of that stability, its citizens built a remarkable society. In Venezuela, the opposite happened. Venezuela used to be a prosperous country. Its middle class was large by regional standards and well-educated. The country had one of the biggest oil reserves in the world. The capital was a clean, modern city. Now there are toilet paper shortages in Caracas. Venezuela has the highest murder rate in the Western Hemisphere. Virtually everyone who can leave already has. How did this happen? Simple. A small number of families took control of most of the Venezuelan economy. Wealth distribution this lopsided would work under many forms of government. It doesn't work in a democracy. Voters deeply resented it. They elected a demagogic populist named Hugo Chavez to show their displeasure. 20 years later, Venezuela is no longer a democracy at all. Its economy has all but evaporated. America isn't Venezuela, but if wealth disparities continue to grow, why wouldn't it be? Our political leaders ought to be concerned. Instead, they work to make the country even less stable by encouraging rapid demographic change. For decades, ever-increasing immigration has been the rule in the United States, endorsed by both political parties. In 1970, less than 5% of America's population were immigrants. By 2018, that number had risen to nearly 14%. This is good news for the leadership of both political parties. Democrats know immigrants vote overwhelmingly for them, so mass immigration is the most effective possible electoral strategy. You don't have to convince or serve voters. You can just import them. Republican donors want lower wages. Many of them have employees. They know immigrants from the third world will work for less and be grateful to do it. Minimum wage seems like a pittance to most Americans, something teenagers get for a summer job. But if you just arrived from a slum in Tegucigalpa, it's a huge improvement over what you're used to. With the enthusiastic consent of both parties, more than 15 million illegal immigrants have been allowed to enter the United States, get jobs, and use public services in a country they are not legally allowed to live in. The people who made the policies benefited from them. What was the effect on the country? Thanks to mass immigration, America has experienced greater demographic change in the last few decades than any other country in history has undergone during peacetime. Our elites relentlessly celebrate these changes, but their very scale destabilizes our society. If you grew up in America, suddenly nothing looks the same. Your neighbors are different, so is the landscape and the customs and very often the languages you hear on the street. You may not recognize your own hometown. Human beings aren't wired for that. They can't digest change at this pace. It disorients them. Over time, it makes even the most open-minded people jumpy and hostile and suspicious of one another. It encourages tribalism. Again and again, we are told these changes are entirely good. Change itself is inherently virtuous, our leaders explain. Those who oppose it are bigots. We must celebrate the fact that a nation that was overwhelmingly European, Christian, and English-speaking 50 years ago has become a place with no ethnic majority, immense religious pluralism, and no universally shared culture or language. It's called diversity. It's our highest value. In fact, diversity is not a value. It's a neutral fact, inherently neither good nor bad. Lost in the mindless celebration of change is an obvious question. Why should a country with no shared language, ethnicity, religion, culture, or history remain a country? Countries don't hang together simply because. They need a reason. What's ours? It's hard to think of a more important question. A ruling class, the people responsible for these changes, ought to be fixated on it. They ought to be staying up late looking for the glue strong enough to hold a country of 330 million people together. They're not. Instead, they act like the problem doesn't exist. Their predictions for the future are confident, but faith-based. All will be well because it always has been. When confronted or pressed for details, they retreat into a familiar platitude, which they repeat like a Zen koan. Diversity is our strength. But is diversity our strength? The less we have in common, the stronger we are? Is that true of families? Is it true in neighborhoods or businesses? Of course not. Then why is it true of America? Nobody knows. Nobody's even allowed to ask the question. Instead, Americans are told to shut up and be grateful. Immigrants are doing the jobs you won't do. There's some truth in this, depending upon what the jobs are and what they pay. But what would happen if those jobs disappeared? One recent study concluded that 20 million low-skilled American jobs could disappear in the next 25 years, replaced by automation. Let's say that's half true, and the country loses 10 million jobs in a relatively short period. What will become of the people who currently occupy them? Many of those workers are recent immigrants, but they won't go home. They'll still live here. How many will be successfully retrained as software engineers? Maybe some. The rest are likely to wind up angry and disenfranchised and wondering what happened to that American dream they were promised in exchange for washing our underwear. It won't take much to convince them to vote for radical populists who will make Donald Trump look restrained. Things could get volatile. The cost of having other people cut your grass is always higher than you think. Policymakers don't seem worried about this, but voters clearly sense a threat. One of the most remarkable things about our immigration policy is how unpopular it is. Only the ruling class supports it. For more than 50 years, Gallup has polled Americans on whether they want more immigration, less immigration, or about the same amount. Not a single time has a plurality supported higher immigration levels. When Americans are asked what their preferred level of annual immigration is, they almost always want less than the current norm of about 1 million new legal immigrants per year. America was radically and permanently changed against the will of its own population by the people who run the country. Dare to complain about that and you'll be shouted down as a bigot, as if demanding representation in a democracy were immoral. Not surprisingly, many voters have concluded that our democracy isn't real. In important ways, it's not. Immigration is far from the only example. From Iraq to Libya to Syria to Yemen, America has embarked on repeated military adventures in the Middle East. None of these wars were waged in response to a genuine existential threat, and none were popular over time. Polls have repeatedly shown that Americans think the country is overstretched and too willing to take on global commitments. Thousands of Americans have died fighting abroad. The wars have cost more than $1 trillion and damaged America's credibility and prestige on the world stage. Enough money has been spent on recent conflicts to retire all student loan debt in America. Yet the world is less stable than it was 15 years ago. Have these wars against terrorism even made America safer from terrorism? It's debatable. One of the main lessons our elites seem to derive from 9/11 is that the best way to fight Islamic terror is to welcome huge numbers of immigrants from places known for Islamic extremism. Pretty much every major foreign policy decision in recent years has been a disaster. Yet elite enthusiasm for nation-building and pointless wars continues unabated. Our leaders still seem more committed to liberating Syrian towns from some armed group or other than to fixing the rotting suburbs in Akron. Our leaders seem less interested than ever in the country they actually govern. Consider the elite response to the opioid epidemic. From 1999 to 2016, the death rate from opioid drugs has risen more than 400%. Drug overdoses are killing more Americans every year than died during the entire Vietnam War. Outside the richest cities, life expectancy is falling for the first time in American history due to a combination of drug overdoses and suicides. If you were around in the 1980s, you may remember the two big health crises of that decade, AIDS and the crack epidemic. Both of these were treated as genuine national emergencies. Billions of dollars went to AIDS research. Hollywood stars wore red ribbons, held galas, made countless public service advertisements to convince kids to shun drugs and use condoms. Congress allocated funding for the National Institutes of Health and passed laws to get drug dealers off the streets. Some of these efforts succeeded, others didn't. But it was obvious that America's leadership regarded crack and AIDS as genuine national emergencies. Today, opioids are killing Americans at a much faster pace than AIDS or crack, but you'd be forgiven for not noticing. It's not a crisis that has interested Washington very much. There's been no effort to rein in the pharmaceutical companies that flooded communities with opioids. Nobody seems to be rethinking our current rehabilitation and treatment models for addicts, which clearly aren't working. Both the Congress and the White House seem to run out of ideas or even the desire to think of new ones. In a healthy society, decades of obvious failures by elites would force a change of ideas or a change of leadership. Neither has happened. The same class of lawmakers, journalists, and business chieftains holds power despite their dismal record. America now has not only one of the least impressive ruling classes in history, but also the least self-aware. They have no idea how bad they are. There's a reason for that. The path to the American elite has been well-marked for decades. Perform well on standardized tests, win admission to an elite school, enter one of a handful of elite professions, settle in a handful of elite zip codes, marry a fellow elite, and reproduce. Repeat that cycle for a couple of generations and you wind up with a ruling class so insulated from the country it rules that failure goes unnoticed. A small group of people accumulates unimaginable wealth while the rest of the country becomes a desiccated husk, yet everything seems fine. The meritocracy, it turns out, creates its own kind of stratification, a kind more rigid than the aristocracy it replaced. Meanwhile, the meritocratic system fails to inculcate the leadership qualities that generational rule requires. Acing the SAT doesn't make you wise. Ascending from McKinsey to Goldman Sachs doesn't confer empathy. That's unfortunate for America because wisdom and empathy are prerequisites for effective leadership. You've got to care about the people you govern. Would you be a good parent if you despised your children? Would you be a good officer if you didn't care about the lives of your soldiers? Our new ruling class doesn't care, and not simply about American citizens, but about the future of the country itself. They view America the way a private equity firm sizes up an aging industrial conglomerate, as something outdated they can profit from. When it fails, they're gone. They've got money offshore and foreign passports at home. Our rulers have no intention of staying for the finale. Countries can survive war and famines and disease. They cannot survive leaders who despise their own people. Increasingly, our leaders work against the public's interests. They view the concerns of middle-class America as superstitious and backward. They fantasize about replacing Americans who live here with their antiquated attitudes and seemingly intractable problems with a new population of more pliant immigrants. Increasingly, Americans have begun to understand this, and they resent it. Historically, rulers derive legitimacy from one of two sources, God or voters. Rulers are in charge either because they claim some higher power put them there, or because a majority of people voted for them. Both systems have been tried for centuries. Both can work. The one system that absolutely does not work, and never will, is ersatz democracy. If you tell people they're in charge, but act as if they're not, you'll infuriate them. It's too dishonest. They'll go crazy. Oligarchies posing as democracies will always be overthrown in the end. That's the story of 2016. What's remarkable is how the ruling class responded. Donald Trump won the Republican primaries, and Republican leaders immediately began plotting to take his nomination at the convention. Trump won the general election, and elites schemed to have the results nullified by electors. Trump assumed office, and the permanent class in Washington worked to sabotage his administration. What message do voters take from this? All your fears are real. You may have suspected our democracy was actually an oligarchy. Now you know for sure. You can vote all you want, but voting is a charade. Your leaders don't care what you think. Shut up and obey. You don't have to support Trump to see this as a dangerous message. Democratic government is a pressure relief valve that keeps societies from exploding. In a democracy, frustrated citizens don't have to burn police stations or storm the Bastille. They can vote. Once they come to believe that voting is pointless, anything can happen. Wise leaders understand this. They're self-reflective and self-critical. When they lose elections, they think about why. Maybe America's most effective government agency is the National Transportation Safety Board, which investigates plane crashes. Anytime a commercial aircraft goes down, the NTSB combs the site of the crash, trying to reverse engineer what happened. Its investigators figure out what went wrong in order to prevent it from happening again. The NTSB is so good at its job that since 2009, there hasn't been a single fatal accident involving a domestic air carrier. If our political and intellectual elites ran the NTSB, they'd respond to plane crashes by blaming Vladimir Putin. They claim the aircraft was piloted by racists or had one too many white men on board. If you dared to point out a mechanical malfunction, they'd accuse you of bigotry against part manufacturers and then ban quality control for good measure. After a while, you'd stop flying. It would be too dangerous. But our leaders wouldn't notice. They'd feel satisfied and virtuous. And in any case, they fly private anyway. Their planes are safe. The aftermath of the 2016 election is recognizable to any parent who has argued with a child. Everything's fine until the kid loses interest in what you think. Once it becomes clear the child really doesn't care about your stupid rules, you lose it and you start screaming. The less control you have, the more hysterical you become. Dying regimes are the same way. They get more repressive as they fade. As their power ebbs, rulers lash out against dissent and disobedience. Deposed Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu barked orders at his guards as they led him to the firing squad. Our leaders understood Trump's election as a direct challenge to their power. They've been fretting about his authoritarian tendencies ever since. Because they lack self-awareness, they don't perceive this as projection. They can't see they're actually talking about themselves. Let's say you were an authoritarian who sought to weaken American democracy. How would you go about doing that? You'd probably start by trying to control what people say and think. If citizens dissented from the mandated orthodoxy or dared to consider unauthorized ideas, you'd hurt them. You'd shame them on social media. You'd shout them down in public. You'd get them fired from their jobs. You'd make sure everyone was afraid to disagree with you. After that, you'd work to disarm the population. You'd take their guns away. That way, they would be entirely dependent on you for safety, not to mention unable to resist your plans for them. Then, just to make sure you'd quelled all opposition, you'd systematically target any institution that might oppose or put brakes on your power. You'd be especially concerned about churches, the family, and independent businesses. You'd be sure to undermine and crush those using laws and relentless propaganda. If, despite all this, election results still didn't go your way, you'd use an unelected bureaucracy to neuter any leader you hadn't handpicked yourself. You'd be shaken by an election like that. You'd resolve never to allow one again. To make sure of that, you'd work tirelessly to replace the old and ungrateful population with a new and more obedient one. That's what you'd do. Sound familiar? For all of his many faults, Donald Trump isn't doing any of that. Our ruling class is. It's probably a fruitless exercise on their part. The status quo is over. A revolution is on the way. Hopefully it'll be the kind of low-grade revolution where everyone learns something and nobody gets hurt. But it will be wrenching either way, because revolutions always are. This used to be a placid country. It's not anymore, and it won't be for a while. What went wrong? The disaster began when almost everyone in power joined the same team. You used to hear debates between Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives, on issues that mattered to the rest of the country. That's over. Our public debates are mostly symbolic. They're sideshows designed to divert attention from the fact that those who make the essential decisions about the economy and the government and war have reached consensus on the fundamentals. They agree with each other. They just don't agree with the population they govern. Left and right are no longer meaningful categories in America. The rift is between those who benefit from the status quo and those who don't. That's rarely acknowledged in public, which is convenient for those who are benefiting. The people in charge are free to pursue policies that are disconnected from the public good, but that have, not coincidentally, made them richer, more powerful, and much more self-satisfied, but not more impressive. Our leaders are fools, unaware that they are captains of a sinking ship. This book is about them. Chapter 1, The Convergence. Not so long ago, politicians didn't argue about transgender bathrooms. Economic questions dominated political campaigns. Tax rates, trade, labor policy, the minimum wage, those were the issues that determined who took office and who retired. The two parties passionately disagreed on economics. Conservatives championed markets, liberals found them threatening. Each side resented the other, but there was a useful balance in the debate. It's hard to go off the rails when the other half of the country is watching your every move. The worst decisions always come from unquestioned bipartisan consensus, which over time is exactly what we got from the leaders of both parties. I watched this convergence. I grew up in California in the 1970s, surrounded by old-fashioned liberals, people who considered market capitalism a communicable disease. I lived in a liberal town, went to a liberal school, had liberal relatives living in my house. My aunt was a nudist who put raw honey in her hair when she sunbathed and later ran an organic mutton farm. Kids in my class smoked weed with their parents. The dominant religion in my neighborhood was astrology. Liberals were everywhere. They smelled like patchouli. They showed up late to everything. They talked incessantly about solar power, humpback whales, and the Hopi Indians. They annoyed the hell out of me. Nobody got on my nerves more than Mrs. Raymond, my first grade teacher. Even by the standards of 1975, Mrs. Raymond was a living parody of Earth Mother liberalism. She wore long Indian print skirts with turtlenecks and sandals and dangly beaded earrings that looked like wind chimes. She had little interest in conventional academic topics like reading and penmanship. Her real passion was socially conscious art projects, so that's what we spent a lot of our class time doing. We made God's eyes from popsicle sticks and yarn in solidarity with the indigenous peoples of Mexico. We finger-painted Greenpeace slogans. We built solar ovens from aluminum foil in protest of fossil fuels and used them to cook lunch. Like a lot of liberals back then, Mrs. Raymond believed that the act of eating entailed important moral choices. Lunch was never just lunch, it was a statement about your values. Mrs. Raymond talked a lot about food. Some foods were virtuous, sprouts and tofu, while others were irredeemably sinful, sugary breakfast cereals. Nothing was more unethical than white bread, which Mrs. Raymond described as a product of ruling class oppression. Medieval lords could afford to have the bran milled from their grain, while the peasants made do with hearty brown loaves. But in the end, the joke was on the lords. With no nutrition in their bread, they died earlier than their macrobiotic serfs. Was any of this true? I have no idea, but it made for a memorable parable. To this day, the sight of Wonder Bread makes me anxious. Mrs. Raymond was obviously political, but she never said so directly. Most of her statements came in the form of questions. Why do you think the settlers did that? Is watering your lawn really a good idea? Or, most commonly, do you think this or that example of capitalism seems fair? She had the gold medal in passive aggression. Mrs. Raymond felt pain at the thought of injustice anywhere, and from her perspective, it was everywhere. Baby seals were being clubbed. Nuclear reactors were being built, people were eating Captain Crunch. One afternoon, she finally snapped under the weight of it all. We filed back into class after recess to find her sitting at the front of the room looking distracted. "Please sit down," she said, "and put your heads on the desks." She turned off the lights and said nothing. For what seemed like an hour, we sat in dark silence. Were we in trouble? Had someone died? It was confusing and kind of scary. Then, without warning, Mrs. Raymond started sobbing, and not quietly, but with theatrical flamboyance in a desperate, trying-to-catch-her-breath-between-convulsions way. I opened my eyes to look, along with everyone else in the class. She met our stares and tried to explain. "The world is so unfair," she yelped. "You don't know that yet, but you'll find out." Mrs. Raymond was a sensitive plant, but she wasn't entirely wrong. As the years passed, the world proved every bit as unfair as she predicted in big ways and small. Almost nothing seemed to be decided fairly, from who gets chosen for the kickball team to who develops ALS to who wins a spot at Harvard Business School. The wicked prosper, the decent suffer, and there's not much we can do about it. A distressingly large percentage of life is beyond our control. It's random, baked in the cake at birth, or else determined by larger forces, hostile or indifferent to our interests. We rarely get what we deserve, for good or bad. This has been true for all of human history, but when I was a kid, it formed the basis of the political divide. Conservatives accepted the basic unfairness of life. Liberals raged against it. As a conservative, I had contempt for the whiny mawkishness of liberals. "Stop blubbering and teach us to read." That was my position. Mrs. Raymond never did teach us. My father had to hire a tutor to get me through phonics. 40 years later, I still feel that way. But I also miss people like Mrs. Raymond. In retrospect, it was important to have sincere liberals around. Someone needs to fret about the excesses of capitalism. When liberals stopped doing that, the country lost a needed counterbalance. In an ecosystem, every species has a role to play, even the pests. If you succeeded in eliminating the mosquitoes, birds would starve. When the last liberals stopped sobbing about unfairness, American society became less fair. It's hard to know exactly when this happened, though it became obvious during the tech boom of the 1990s. That's the first time I remember wondering why liberals weren't complaining about big business. Until then, whining about corporate power had been the soundtrack of the left. Businessmen were bad, the more successful, the more sinister. For 100 years, from the progressive era to the second Clinton administration, liberals never ceased making that point. And then one day, they stopped. I remember picking up Newsweek and seeing America's new corporate chieftains described as heroes. Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, the Google guys. Nobody was accusing them of exploiting workers or getting too rich. Just the opposite. Liberals were celebrating their wealth and assuring us their products could liberate the world. Conservatives didn't complain. They'd always celebrated business. Suddenly, both sides were aligned on the virtues of unrestrained market capitalism. Before long, left and right were taking virtually indistinguishable positions on many economic issues, especially on wages. Mass immigration? The Chamber of Commerce had long supported more of it. Liberals were now on board, too. Self-driving cars, drone delivery of packages? Trucking companies love the idea. It means they won't have to pay drivers. Lawmakers in both parties love the idea, too. It's such impressive technology. If America doesn't lead the way, someone else will. Neither side mentions the potential effect on employment. There are more than 3 million professional truck drivers in the United States. Driving is the most common job in the majority of states, the biggest single employer in blue-collar America. Technology is poised to destroy all of those jobs and the communities they support overnight. Washington isn't worried. Democrats assure doubters that those truck drivers will be just fine. They'll find something else to do, something better with higher pay. That's almost exactly what corporate Republicans said about disappearing manufacturing jobs 30 years ago. The difference is 30 years ago, they were pro-labor Democrats to push back. Ironically, some of the most successful players in the new economy, the ones who were going to free us from drudgery, have embraced the most retrograde labor practices. Think migrant farm workers have it bad? Talk to anyone who works in an Amazon fulfillment center, where every step an employee takes is tracked electronically by management. Fail to account for a 5-minute period and you're punished. No textile mill ever dehumanized its workers more thoroughly. Yet when was the last time you heard a liberal criticize working conditions at Amazon? You won't. Amazon is the future. Jeff Bezos supported Hillary for president. So did virtually all the most successful CEOs. Amazingly, liberals supported them back. The distinction between successful businessman and progressive political activist gets blurrier by the day. The few sincere liberals left, the ones actually fighting corporate power, seem like bewildered relics from an earlier age. For generations, there was no more famous activist on the left than Ralph Nader. Nader became a national figure in 1965 when he published his book Unsafe at Any Speed. Nader accused Detroit of knowingly selling dangerous cars. The charge was basically true. General Motors responded by discontinuing the Chevrolet Corvair. The company also tapped Nader's phones and, it later admitted, hired prostitutes to seduce him. If life were fair, Nader would be living out his days in a socialist retirement home in Florida, greeting a parade of awestruck liberal pilgrims. Instead, he's mostly reviled by his former admirers. His crime? Daring to run for president in 2000. Democrats blamed him for Al Gore's narrow loss to George W. Bush. They never stopped blaming him. Ralph Nader still refuses to admit he elected Bush, read a headline in New York Magazine 16 years after the election. By the time Trump became president, Nader was mostly forgotten. He lived in a small apartment in Washington, writing op-eds that he posted to his own lightly trafficked website. Nader's politics never changed. He still believed that unchecked corporate power posed a threat to American democracy. By the summer of 2017, he'd turned his sights on the most powerful corporate leader of all, Jeff Bezos of Amazon. Quote, as Amazon spreads around the world, selling everything and squeezing other businesses that use its platform, Nader wrote, is Bezos laughing at humanity? His ultimate objective seems to preside over a mega-trillion-dollar global juggernaut that is largely automated, except for that man at the top with the booming laugh who rules over the means by which we consume everything from goods to media to groceries. Nader went on to attack Bezos for crushing labor unions and creating a dangerous monopoly that hurts consumers. Every point Nader made was fair. Some were indisputably true. Nobody cared. By 2017, liberals and Jeff Bezos were playing for the same team. Bezos is now the owner of the Washington Post, the most aggressively anti-Trump newspaper in the United States. To liberals, Bezos wasn't a corporate villain. He was a role model. Slate, the online newsletter of well-educated young progressives in New York and Washington, published stories with headlines like The Peculiar Genius of Jeff Bezos. 2 weeks after Nader posted his worries about Amazon's effect on unions and consumers, Slate wrote this about Bezos, quote, the Amazon CEO and Washington Post owner showed up to an Idaho conference in a skin-tight T-shirt last week, displaying a set of arms most reasonable observers would classify as assault weapons. It's hard to imagine Slate writing anything at all about Ralph Nader, even gushy pieces about his arms. Nader is a living rebuke to modern liberalism. Not only did he once dare to run for president without permission, but he's consistently refused to suck up to power. Modern progressives despise him for that above all. The Democratic Party is now the party of the rich. 8 of America's 10 most affluent counties voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, in most cases by a large margin. In Fairfield County, Connecticut, the hedge fund capital of the world, Hillary Clinton won by nearly 20 points. In Nantucket, she won by more than 30 points. In Aspen, she won by more than 45 points. In Marin County, the privileged enclave across the Golden Gate from San Francisco, Hillary Clinton's margin was greater than 50 points. In Manhattan, by contrast, Trump won less than 10% of the vote. In the District of Columbia, he got 4%, a smaller proportion than third-party candidates and write-ins combined. Historically, most highly paid executives voted Republican, no more. In the weeks before the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump 20-1 among people on the Bloomberg Billionaires Index. A Wall Street Journal analysis found that hedge fund owners and employees donated a total of $27.6 million to the Hillary Clinton campaign and affiliated groups. When the category was expanded to include similar private investment funds, the journal found that 7 financial firms alone donated $47.6 million to Hillary. Trump received a total of $19,000, about the price of a used pickup. Employees of Google, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon donated to Hillary over Trump by a margin of 60-1. George Soros was on the leading edge of this trend. Long before he became famous as one of the biggest Democratic donors in history, Soros was best known for getting rich by betting against national currencies, notably the English pound. Soros was considered such a rapacious and unethical practitioner of vulture capitalism that liberal economist Paul Krugman once accused him of intentionally trying to provoke currency crises in order to profit from them. Krugman no longer criticizes Soros, who has gone on to spend billions on behalf of liberal candidates and policy positions around the world. It now seems normal for businessmen to finance the activist left. A generation or two ago, it would have been inconceivable. Try to imagine Dow Chemical, makers of Agent Orange, funding anti-war protests during Vietnam. Or maybe General Motors backing the UAW during the auto strike of 1946. That's what it's like. Weird, at the very least. It's also inevitable. In 1980, Yippie icon Jerry Rubin gave up protesting capitalism to work on Wall Street. Well-educated baby boom liberals began to join the establishment in droves. By the late 1990s, they were in charge. Thanks to the rise of the finance economy, they were getting richer than any previous generation ever had. Nothing changes a person's attitude toward money like earning a lot of it. It's hard to feel rage toward the man when you're buying a ski house in Sun Valley. So young liberals grew up and became the establishment they once despised. That's a familiar story. What's new is that this new class felt little responsibility to those beneath them. The meritocracy convinced them that the existing order is the natural order. Designed by well-meaning academics to make American society fairer, standardized testing transformed the attitudes of the privileged. Unlike the 19th century robber barons, relatively few in the modern ruling class had ever lived among their employees. Andrew Carnegie, by contrast, went to work in a cotton mill at 13. They had little understanding of the defining role luck often plays in life. People who do the right thing often fail anyway. Human power has limits. You're not always the sum of your choices. That was hard to deny 100 years ago when even tycoons routinely watched their children suffocate from diphtheria. The main reason elites no longer talk about unfairness is that they don't believe it exists. They're successful because they deserve to be. That's the message of the system they grew up in. The flip side of believing the rich deserve it is deciding the poor do too. This is the unspoken but core assumption of modern American elites. I went to Yale and live on 10 acres in Greenwich because I worked hard and made wise choices. You're unemployed and live in an apartment in Cleveland because you didn't. The system doesn't produce equal results, yet it's still basically fair because the best people inevitably rise to the top. The affluent now believe that. It's a kind of secular Calvinism. This is not an improvement over what Mrs. Raymond was pushing. The best thing about old-fashioned liberals was how guilty they were. They felt bad about everything, and that kept them empathetic and humane. It also made them instinctively suspicious of power, which was useful. Somebody needs to be. In March 1911, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in Lower Manhattan caught fire. Close to 150 people died, nearly half after jumping from upper floors onto the sidewalk. The fire started accidentally when a garment worker dropped a lit cigarette into a bin of fabric cuttings. But the high death toll could have been prevented. The company's owners had padlocked interior doors to prevent theft, trapping workers in the flames. Those who made it to the exits found the tiny stairwells clogged with bodies. Scores were crushed. The few who reached the shoddily made fire escape fell to their deaths when it detached from the side of the building. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire was a human disaster, the deadliest fire in the history of New York at the time. But soon it became notorious around the world as a metaphor for the mistreatment of workers. Dozens of books, countless pamphlets were written about the fire. The Ladies International Garment Workers Union swelled to become one of the most powerful forces in organized labor. For decades, what happened at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory was a rallying cry of the progressive movement. Fast forward 100 years. The Ladies International Garment Workers Union is long gone. It was dissolved in the 1990s. But so are the attitudes that celebrated it. Millions of people around the world still work in factories, but you don't hear much about them. What would happen if there were the equivalent of a Triangle Shirtwaist Fire at, say, an iPhone factory in China? Would anyone care? Actually, we know the answer. The phone you have in your pocket right now was likely made in China by Foxconn, a Taiwanese company that is the biggest electronics manufacturer in the world. The workers who assembled it make less than $2 an hour. Even by Chinese standards, that's not a lot. Foxconn employees who make iPhones would have to work for months to afford one. The work at Foxconn is repetitive and hard, the pressure from management unrelenting. Some workers have reported being forced to stand for 24 hours at a time. Others say they're beaten by their supervisors. Starting around 2010, employees at Foxconn plants in China began to kill themselves in alarming numbers. Workers hanged themselves, took poison, jumped from windows. There was very little news coverage of any of it until 2012. That year, about 150 Foxconn workers at a plant in Wuhan climbed to the roof of their factory and threatened to commit mass suicide if conditions didn't improve. The company responded by installing circus nets beneath the railings. All pretty grim. When was the last time you heard a politician decry Apple's treatment of workers, let alone introduce legislation intended to address it? When was the last time a group of socially conscious hipsters from Brooklyn protested outside the home of Apple CEO Tim Cook? Never, of course. That's because Apple, like virtually every other big employer in American life, has purchased indulgences from the Church of Cultural Liberalism. Apple has a gay CEO with fashionable social views. The company issues statements about green energy and has generous domestic partner benefits. Apple publicly protested the Trump administration's immigration policies. The company is progressive in ways that matter in Brooklyn. That's enough to stop any conversation about working conditions in Foxconn factories. Indeed, the whole point is not to talk about Foxconn factories. As Notre Dame professor Patrick Deneen points out, the ruling class's, quote, insistent defense of equality is a way of freeing themselves from any real duties to the lower classes that are increasingly out of geographical sight and mind. Because they repudiate inequality, they need not consciously consider themselves to be a ruling class. A resolute lack of self-awareness makes this arrangement possible. Earlier ruling classes understood they were in charge. They admitted it and faced the consequences, including a responsibility to those beneath them. Noblesse oblige means obligations of the nobility. Every functioning aristocracy has taken that obligation seriously. The modern rich, by contrast, don't acknowledge that they're at the top of the economic heap, or even that a heap exists. They pretend they're just like everyone else, just more impressive. They deny, Deneen writes, quote, that they really are a self-perpetuating elite that not only has inherited certain advantages, but also seeks to pass them on. To mask this fact, they describe themselves as the vanguard of equality, in effect denying the very fact of their elevated status and the deleterious consequences of their perpetuation of a class divide that has left their less fortunate countrymen in a dire and perilous condition. Meanwhile, the nameless workers whose heavily discounted labor has helped push Apple's market cap ever closer to $1 trillion live in stinking dormitories in towns you can't pronounce and are killing themselves in desperation, and no one cares. 40 years ago, the suffering of Chinese workers would have offended the elite's sense of decency and fairness. Rich housewives in the Upper East Side would have made a cause out of it. Celebrities would have denounced Foxconn in talk show appearances. Someone would have mentioned oppressed Chinese workers in an Oscar speech. Today, the ruling class is silent, indeed unconcerned. Liberals view Apple as the apex of tech chic. The company's business practices aren't merely tolerated, they're celebrated. College graduates compete to work in its sad, spare retail stores wearing dopey matching t-shirts and selling laptops. This may all seem normal now, but it is a relatively new development. In 1974, journalist Studs Terkel published a book called Working, an Oral History of What People Do for a Living. Terkel was a 1930s-era socialist from Chicago, but for the most part, he kept his opinions out of the book. He let his subjects speak. One man he interviewed described what it was like to be a machinist. Another talked about spending his life as a doorman in an apartment building. It was a window into a world elites knew little about, but they were interested. Working became a huge bestseller and then a Broadway musical. James Taylor wrote part of the score. The play was nominated for 5 Tony Awards. Liberals loved the book because it highlighted the dignity of working people. If Working came out today, how many copies would it sell in Brookline or Marin County? Not enough to justify publishing it. Unless the machinist was transitioning to a new gender or fighting immigration authorities over an expired visa, modern elites wouldn't care. Huge corporations have displaced the blue-collar proletariat in the hearts of elites. Corporations embrace a progressive agenda that, from an accounting perspective, costs them nothing. In exchange, they get to maintain the economic status quo that has made them billions. The company's affluent customers get to imagine they're fighting the power by purchasing the products, even as they make a tiny group of people richer and more powerful. There's never been a more brilliant marketing strategy. Days after a mass shooting in the summer of 2016, San Francisco-based Uber sent a message to users announcing that, quote, "Our hearts go out to the victims of this week's terrible gun violence," and calling for a moment of silence to reflect upon it. For emphasis, peace signs appeared on the Uber app. Quote, "As we move around our cities this weekend, let's take a moment to think about what we can do to help," the company suggested. One obvious thing Uber might have done to help, treat its own employees more humanely. At the very moment Uber was using its app to showcase its own decency, the corporation supervised more than 1 million drivers. In a traditional company, every one of these workers would be classified as an employee, which would make Uber the second largest private sector employer in the world. But employees are expensive. They require vacation days and healthcare benefits. They have rights. In the United States, employees receive unemployment insurance and they're entitled to compensation for on-the-job injuries. With a value greater than the gross domestic product of some African countries, Uber could have paid for all of that. Its owners didn't want to. So instead, Uber maintained the conceit that its drivers weren't employees, but contractors, independent small business owners who just happened to be using Uber as a way to go find customers. It was a semantic trick of incalculable value to the company, but it didn't change the fact that Uber was running an enormously valuable business on the backs of exploited workers. A 2018 study at MIT found that fully three-quarters of Uber drivers earned less than the minimum hourly wage in the states where they were driving. Almost a third of them lost money in the deal. In effect, they were paying Uber to drive. It was a pretty good deal for Uber. The company's 39-year-old founder had a personal net worth of $5 billion. The usual watchdogs didn't seem to notice any of this. Instead of being denounced as exploitative, Uber was lauded as a pioneer, a corporate John the Baptist, heralding the arrival of a savior called the gig economy. Low pay, no benefits, unsteady hours, whatever. An obedient business press instead focused on the flexibility Uber's contractors supposedly enjoyed. Happy workers cheerfully making America better. An earlier generation of liberals would have recognized how awful all this is. Feudal lords took more responsibility for their serfs than Uber does for its drivers. Yet Uber executives weren't ashamed. They didn't need to be. They sold exploitation as opportunity, and virtually nobody called them on it. Indeed, when high-profile controversies did hit Uber, they had nothing to do with the company's labor practices. Outrage erupted instead over the superficial issues that now routinely inflame the modern ruling class. In January 2017, protesters chained themselves to the front doors of Uber San Francisco headquarters. Why? Because founder and CEO Travis Kalanick had agreed to participate in a business advisory board established by President-elect Donald Trump. In June 2017, Kalanick resigned. Once again, his perceived sins had nothing to do with how he treated his drivers, many of whom lived in poverty. Instead, Kalanick was brought down by allegations of widespread sexism at the company. Quote, "a toxic brand of corporate machismo," as the Washington Post put it. After Kalanick left, the Post ridiculed Uber for failing to replace him with a new female CEO. The marriage of market capitalism to progressive social values may be the most destructive combination in American economic history. Someone needs to protect workers from the terrifying power of market forces, which tend to accelerate change to intolerable levels and crush the weak. For generations, labor unions filled that role. That's over. Left and right now agree that a corporation's only real responsibility is to its shareholders. Companies can openly mistreat their employees or contractors, but for the price of installing transgender bathrooms, they buy a pass. Shareholders win, workers lose. Bowing to the diversity agenda is a lot cheaper than raising wages. Marissa Mayer figured this out early. A longtime Google executive, Mayer spent 5 years running the tech giant Yahoo. During that time, she became one of the most famous business leaders in America and definitely one of the richest. How did Yahoo do? Under Mayer's leadership, the company's business model collapsed completely. Yahoo shed half its employees. Mayer responded by making several disastrous acquisitions. She bought the blogging platform Tumblr for more than $1 billion, a ludicrous overvaluation. Meanwhile, Yahoo neglected its most basic duties to customers, allowing massive privacy breaches that exposed users' personal data to hackers. In the face of all this, Mayer mounted a public relations campaign that emphasized her role